From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Tim Wilson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm filling in for Terry Gross today. One of my guests will be Bebe Moore Campbell. As a child, she spent most of the year with her mother and grandmother here in Philadelphia, but each summer she left the city to visit her father in North Carolina. That contrast between a proper upbringing in the city, with women she called the bosoms, and the barefoot, big-hearted lifestyle she shared with her daddy, are the subject of her new memoir. On today's Fresh Air, Growing Up With and Without Dad. Also today, growing a green cathedral in the modern world. We meet James Parks Morton, Dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. And we have reviews of three new albums by Soviet rock bands and of the new movie Ghostbusters 2. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. When Bebe Moore Campbell's parents got a divorce, it opened up two worlds to the young girl. For most of the year, she lived with her mother and grandmother here in Philadelphia. That was a world of advice and Christian morality. These maternal figures were a tad protective. That's why she called them the bosoms. Summers, though, she'd spend with her father in North Carolina in a world of men, with Fruit of the Loom hanging on the clothesline and baseball games on TV. Campbell has written a memoir called Sweet Summer, Growing Up With and Without My Dad. In it, she reflects on the male and female influences that shaped her childhood and on the two worlds of black culture she lived in the North and in the South. Campbell is also the author of a book about pressures in contemporary marriages titled Successful Women, Angry Men, Backlash in the Two-Career Marriage. Bebe Moore Campbell is my guest today. I asked her to begin by reading an excerpt from her new book, Sweet Summer.
It has proved to be true what I felt looking into my father's satin-lined casket. My loss was more than his death, much more. Those men who used to entice me with their storytelling, yank my plaits, throw me quarters, and tell me what a pretty girl I was, are mostly beyond my reach now. But that's all right. When they were with me, they were very much with me. My father took to his grave the short-sleeved, beer-swilling men of summer, big bellies, raucous laughter, pipe smoke, and the aroma of cigars. My daddy is really gone, and his vacant place is my cold, hard border. As always, my life is framed by his absence.
Bebe Moore Campbell, Bill Cosby is right. This is a wonderful book. And for those who are summer daddies like myself, with, in fact, a 7-year-old little girl, it really comes right home. I wonder, can you go back to when you were a 7-year-old? About this time of year, I guess it would be.
Yeah.
Towards the end of June.
Right.
You're sitting on your stone steps, bap, bap, bapping your heel against the step and waiting for your daddy to come around the corner.
Well, there was a terrific feeling of anticipation after school ended, because I knew I was about to be transported from one world to another. I was about to leave, you know, the asphalt, the pavement of Philadelphia, the home on 16th Street, where I live with my mother, my grandmother, sometimes my aunt, and always my cousin. But this world of perfume and Jergens hand lotion and women. And I was about to be transported down to rural North Carolina with the dismal swamp and the lane that was unpaved that led to my grandmother's house, and spend the next 2.5 months with my father. And so it was just transporting me to another world. And I just, at 7, my father was the king for me. And so I was sitting on the steps waiting for the king to come get me and transport me and take me. And I anticipated everything about it. I wanted that first glimpse of him. I wanted to get in his car. I wanted to go to my Uncle Eddie's market, which was around the corner from my mother, so that we could get sodas and stuff for our trip.
And you could show off your daddy's and his big green and Buick. And,
that's right.
Or Pontiac, I guess.
Pontiac.
Right.
And I wanted the long ride. It wasn't, you know, I didn't mind that it was long. I never asked, you know.
How long was it?
then it was about 8 or 9 hours, because now they have the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, but then we had a ferry. So just the ferry trip alone was like at least an hour or two waiting in line and getting on. And so it was a long trip, but it certainly was the highlight of my summer.
Now, I was struck by how much touch is a part of your memory here. You were touching one another all the time. He'd have his big, thick arm on your shoulder. You'd be holding his wrist. And I remember just how vivid that is for you, just the physical presence of...
My father was, I guess you call him touchy-feely. The texture of him, I mean, my mother and my grandmother and my aunt were also, so I come from hugs and kisses on both sides. But his touch, of course, was a manly touch, and so I remember it because it was so different. I only got that, 2.5, 3 months out of the year, whereas I was clasped into these bosoms for most of the rest of the year.
Now, it's important, obviously, in the story, an important element of this story is your father was a paraplegic. He'd been in a car accident
right.
When you were very young.
When I was 10 months old.
So he had to lift himself out of the car and always had a wheelchair with him. And
he
what,
had
was he a kind of wounded man in your eyes? Was he flawed in any way for that?
No. If anything, I saw him as a child as special. I saw him as someone who, you have to understand, I never saw my father walk in any of my memories. I was 10 months old when he had that car accident. So I just saw him as a special person. Because I had him on such a pedestal, my feeling was that somehow some wicked person had done this to him. Because I wasn't getting any input from anybody when I was very young as to how this accident had happened. And it was one of the challenges of growing up to come to grips with the fact that my father was not this perfect king that I had always placed on a pedestal, but he was a flawed human being who drove too fast.
Did he? Oh, that's why he was in the accident?
Well, he was the only one involved in this accident, and he drove fast.
And yet he tried to show you that he really was all there in physical strength. He changed the tire when you were driving
right.
down at one point.
Yeah, and I guess that's why my father never exuded helplessness. Quite the opposite. He washed his car. He changed a tire. He was very. He bowled. He played basketball. So I saw him as not able-bodied, but not helpless.
I'm talking with B.B. Moore Campbell. Her new memoir, "Sweet Summer: Growing Up with and Without My Dad." Robert Bly, a poet whose stuff I and a lot of men are interested in, talks about what is missing when the physical presence of the dad isn't there, not just for girls, but for children, period. And he says it after the Industrial Revolution, even. Girls could always chat in the kitchen with their grandmas and their mothers, but we have on average 10 minutes a day with their fathers. That physical presence is really mm-hmm. important. Is there anything in that for you? Just what does that bring?
Well, when I think of what I wouldn't have had if I hadn't had the time with my father, what he gave for me as a daughter, and I think it is what men give their little girls, is the expectation that I should be loved and should be cherished by a man at some point. He made that the norm for me. Whereas if you don't have that, I'm not saying this is the sole reason, but I think a lot of women have difficulty overcoming not having had that input from a father when they later on grow up and have relationships and marriages with adult men. Fathers set the groundwork for little girls.
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is when fathers are, and this can a father can be in the house and not be nurturing and not be giving, but certainly when a father is there for his little girl, whether he's a father of divorce, part-time parent, or in the home, his presence says to her, you're lovable, you're worthwhile, you're worth daddy coming over to get you on a weekend, you're worth daddy coming 9 hours from North Carolina to pick you up every summer. And that builds self-esteem. On the other hand, when that's...
Even if you try and test him by freaking him out with wild hairdos and everything
yeah,
else?
Yeah, but I mean, the bottom line is if you get this message early enough, it builds a base of security that'll last you for the rest of your life.
And yet you portray your father as not totally without flaws. I mean, he farts.
Yes, he did.
And not so slyly.
No, not so slyly. Yeah, that was, you didn't hear farts in the home of the bosoms, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, a little poots maybe, but I mean, my father's passing gas could really shake the house down, and you didn't want to be around when it happened, but it was one of the textures of my childhood, so to speak, and something I remember. You know, that was, you know, he was a man. He did manly things in a manly way.
Now, where did you come to see, though, that he might have more fundamental weaknesses, let's say? I mean, that's not a weakness to fart, but...
No. Well, I think I began to see, you know, once I began to get a grip on how my father got hurt, how that accident occurred, I began to see someone who really put a lot of stock into a fast car. And I think it was, I don't think of my father as a daredevil, but I think he was a very, very aggressive, ambitious man, a black man coming up in North Carolina in the, you know, 20s, 30s, and 40s, and he wanted a lot. And I think, and this is not as an excuse because people speed for whatever reasons, but I think part of his feeling important was tied into having a car and really feeling powerful behind the wheel.
Your grandma didn't seem to mind that. His mother.
I mean, no.
The part in the book where she says, that's okay, he yeah. wants to drive his fast car.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my grandmother loved her children, and everything that that they did was okay by her, most things. I mean, she forgave them for most things.
But you haven't really forgiven him for being that reckless with himself.
I think because I had put him on so high a pedestal when I was little, if I had known early on the cause then for my father's paralysis, then it would have been easier to make, you know, to never put him on a pedestal than to have him fall off. I thought this man was perfect, and then to find out that he was reckless and that he drove too fast, I was very angry. I was very angry for a while, but I think part of growing up and part of maturing was my coming to grips with that and accepting him as not the king, you know, but daddy with some flaws.
Did your mother ever give you the impression that she either resented or was jealous of how close you were with him?
Oh, no, never, never. My mother wanted that. My mother's very smart, and she's, you know, a trained social worker, so she knows all that stuff about what daddies do for little girls. So
she
absolutely wanted me to have a close relationship with him. And again, whatever hostility they had toward each other, they were able to manage it so that it didn't interfere with either of their relationships with me. You know, he held her in high esteem. As far as I was concerned, she held him in high esteem.
And he died before, he died when you were about
27.
Seven, and by that time you had married?
I had married, and I had a child. My child, Maia, was 4 months old when my father was killed in another car accident.
Uh-huh. Tell me about your summers now in the South. It just from the first couple of chapters of your book, they're glorious, like you're a pig in whatever the opposite of New Nile is.
Well... I have to preface it. Summers in North Carolina, or North Carolina in the 50s, was a very, very segregated place to be. Couldn't go to movies, couldn't go to the library. It was very rural. And I think I say this to say that my family was so protective, and by that I mean my father, my grandmother, my cousins, my extended family, that I didn't feel all of that. I saw it whizzing by as I'd go down the highway and see the for colored signs, for white signs, but it didn't really get into my marrow. And I think that's what a family can do for you. They can protect you. And of course, I was a visitor in a, to a certain extent. I didn't go to a segregated school in North Carolina where they would not have been able to protect me from that. But the summers for me, instead of being harsh places of repression that North Carolina was for a lot of black people, summers were this time where there were all these flowers, a lot of hummingbirds, trees to climb, chickens to chase, dogs to run around with, hogs. And most important was that summer was a time when all my uncles and aunts came back on Labor Day and we had family reunion. So I got to see cousins that I hadn't seen, both from North Carolina and Virginia and from Philadelphia and other points north. So it was a reunion time, and it was certainly a time with no pressures. I mean, you didn't have homework to do, you didn't have manners, everything
absolute
could slide
bliss.
A little bit, yeah.
But was there anything in you that wanted to look down on that from the heights of where your bosoms, the Philadelphia background was, and say, this is a bit just hick? And
no.
Was there anything in you that was critical of that?
No. Late as I grew up and got to be an adolescent and got interested in boys, then I said, this is too slow. And then again, we're talking about having a boyfriend back in Philadelphia, and you're up a muddy lane with no phone. What was paradise at 7, 8, 9, 10 became less so at the age of 14, 15, 16, because then I wanted more of what Philadelphia had to offer.
You didn't have any boyfriends down in South Carolina?
No. North Carolina, no.
North Carolina, yeah. My guest is writer B.B. Moore Campbell. Her new memoir, Sweet Summer, tells of how her parents' divorce opened up two worlds to her, the world up north in Philadelphia with the bosoms and summers in the south with her father. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with B.B. Moore Campbell, her new memoir, Sweet Summer, Growing Up With and Without My Dad. So we've got you to 14 and with boyfriends waiting for you in Philadelphia, calling long distance down to...
Not calling long distance, no phone, writing.
Oh, I see. Things must have had to change with your dad at that point, too. You couldn't be as physical with him, I guess. You weren't able to sleep with him.
Oh, no. Yeah, when I was little, I slept with in the bed with my father and enjoyed that because we'd talk a lot and... And then one summer, I think I was about 9 or 10, I came down and my grandmother had removed me. I put my bags in my father's room and she just said, you're not sleeping there. And I said, why not? And she said, you're too big. And she sent me upstairs to sleep with my cousin, Bunny. And I was just very upset about this because I liked that time with my father. I liked the talking. And I said, well, you know, talk to her, telling my father, talk to your mother. And he agreed. He said, no, you are too big. You have to go upstairs with Cousin Bunny. And I began to understand it a few years down the road, but that was really traumatic for me then.
Almost a rejection.
Yeah, I couldn't be with my daddy, who I idolized, you know.
He spent a lot of time with other men, and you had his brothers, the seven brothers. But it was a kind of mystery world, too, yes? I mean, there were times when they'd say, B.B., just take off. This is men talk now.
Yeah, they would be out. My grandmother had a lot of land around her house, and so they'd line up their cars, and they all had very nice cars, Fords and Pontiacs and big, shiny cars, and they'd wash them. And, you know, they'd take their shirts off, and I'd come creeping up to hear what they were saying, and they might be saying something they didn't want me to hear. So they'd sort of indulge me for a little while, then maybe I'd get chased away. But I much preferred their company to being with my aunts and the women and my grandmother.
Now, why was that?
I mean, because it was different. I didn't have that most of the time in Philadelphia. I was around women all the time, and I liked being around men. And these were men who were nurturing, who would tell me I was cute, who would give me a quarter, who would pull my plaits, who made it clear that they liked me a lot. I mean, they didn't want me to be around if they were maybe saying a cuss word or two, so that then I would be banished, but they liked my company.
Well, your aunt and mother and grandmother loved you, presumably.
Oh, I love them too.
I'm not trying to defend them, except
I love
just
them
wondering
too.
What, yeah.
I love them too, but I wanted that different energy that I didn't get the whole school year. And I missed them very much, and I was always very happy to get back to see them again. But I don't know if there's such a thing as male deprivation, but I didn't have enough maleness in my life during the school year, and I just absorbed every bit of it that came my way when I was down in North Carolina.
So are you directing this book mostly to mothers to say, leave room,
angry? Well, one of my messages is, if it is possible for mothers and fathers to come to grips. A lot of times, I shouldn't say a lot of times, but sometimes men aren't a positive influence on their children. Particularly during these times, you got men on drugs, you got men that you don't want around your kids. But sometimes a man who's maybe struggling out of work has a positive contribution to make that isn't financial. The society being as it is, sometimes women can't see what that man can provide and is giving the message, look, if you don't have a check, just don't bother to come around here. What I'm saying to those women is to look for ways to make it possible. I think we've got to start being creative about child support. It may not always need to be money. Sometimes it may be time. Sometimes that ex-husband who's out of work, if he'll take care of the kids, if he'll watch them, again, if he's a positive person, that frees up the mother who is working to maybe, you know, work longer, do overtime, go back to school, that kind of thing. A lot of time you've got fathers who, and mothers being hostile, fathers don't, maybe they're working, they don't want to give this woman money. They're saying she's going to spend it on the boyfriend, she's going to spend it on herself. Okay, if that's the problem, I think, and again, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not an expert, but my feeling is in beginning to work out this anger, what is to prevent a man from going to the home where his children live, ringing the doorbell, and leaving two bags of groceries? What is to prevent him from going to that same door, leaving clothes in his children's size? Why can't he find out who babysits his children and give the check directly to that person? Get the pediatrician and send the check directly to him. In other words, when men are serious about providing for their children, they find ways of doing it, even if they're very angry with their ex-wives.
That's asking a lot,
but it means a lot. It means more than I'm asking for. It means the future of their children.
I'm talking with B.B. Moore Campbell, whose new memoir is Sweet Summer, Growing Up With and Without My Dad. Talking about the way young daughters particularly are with men, it's one of the sadnesses of the way things are is that we look at an old man, say your uncle's age or with young girls, and we look askance at them being physical with one another. That's extreme, but there are ways that we don't seem to encourage in the culture the kind of just hanging out.
Mm-hmm. Certainly when we have a father missing from a household with a young boy, the society steps in to provide a role model for that boy. We've got police athletic league. We've got big brothers. We've got boys clubs. We don't do that for little girls. The society assumes that mothers are enough of a role model for daughters, so therefore if the father is not around, that little girl is still going to come out okay. And I don't know what the answer for that is, actually, because, you know, we're a society now. We're learning about molestation. We're learning about all kinds of awful things. And I think we're a bit paranoid about certainly partnering a grown adult strange male with a small girl.
Or even the father of the
sometimes
girl.
That. Yeah, but I think we've got to become aware of how much and how necessary fathers are to daughters, and how much little girls need that male image in their lives. And we've got to, you know, find the safest male, so to speak, in that situation, whether that's the father, the grandfather, the uncle, or the neighbor next door. I think mothers have got to become aware, if they're the custodial parent, and they're 90% of the time they are, that their daughters need input from men as much as their sons.
There's a wonderful character in your book. Is it Mr. Abe? No, he wasn't an uncle.
He was my step-grandfather, yeah.
But tell me about him.
Oh, Mr. Abe was...
He would sing all the time.
Yeah, he was my grandmother, my father's mother's second husband, and he was a farmer and a man of very, very few words, but a man who would sing every night. He sat in a chair. He had few pastimes. He had a huge storybook of Bible stories with huge and large print because his eyes weren't that good. He read that and the Bible every night, and he sang. He would sing for like 2 hours a night. He would just sit in a chair and hum, moan, sing hymns, and they were hymns I've never heard anywhere before or since. I heard him sing them, and they really...
Did you learn them yourself? Were you able to sing them to Maia?
Never. I mean, it was not music you'd go out of the house humming. It was just, these were Mr. Abe's songs, and... But they were like background music for my whole North Carolina experience. But again, I never, you know, they were just, it was humming, it was moaning, it was very ancient music. I could tell it was ancient music.
When you were writing this, did you go back and talk with any of your relatives just to get details right, or was
Yes.
it all there?
Yeah, I talked with some uncles and some aunts. I talked with... cousins, and I talked with old friends. I remembered a lot, but I didn't remember everything, so I had to talk with some people.
But your nose had a good memory.
I remembered my smells, yes, I did. I remembered the smell of the hair pomade my Nana used to put on my hair, New Nile, which sort of smelled peachy, apricotty, and I remembered... the smell of her pound cake and their perfumes. Living with a house of women, it's like being in a perfume store. And the Avon, the Topaz cream sachet, and Intimate that my Aunt Ruth wore, and Emerald that my mother wore, and my first grade teacher wore Emerald. And so, yeah, I remember all those scents. I don't know why I remember them, but I do.
It's a wonderful read. It's a wonderful smell. B.B. Moore Campbell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
B.B. Moore Campbell's new book is Sweet Summer, Growing Up With and Without My Dad. It's published by Putnam. I'm Tim Wilson. This is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with Sabine Reichel. She was born in Germany right after World War II. She says she feels as though her youth was spent surrounded by the entire alumni of the Third Reich. Her new book, What Did You Do in the War, Daddy?, tells how she came to grips with her country's Nazi past and her parents' deafening silence. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Tim Wilson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross. 8 centuries ago in Europe, work began on the first Gothic cathedral. Today in New York, work continues on the world's largest and perhaps the world's last Gothic cathedral, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. Coming up, James Parks Morton, Dean of the Cathedral, talks about making his beloved building the center of a modern community. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from 3 Soviet rock acts trying to make it in the West. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Ghostbusters 2, the further adventures of a group of guys trying to save New York from the spirit world. Wonder if the Dean's heard of them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Frank Stachow. A divided Supreme Court today upheld a 1976 decision that made it illegal to discriminate in private contracts. At issue in the case was a post-Civil War statute that has become an important tool for fighting employment discrimination. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1976, the Supreme Court, in a landmark ruling, agreed with civil rights advocates that the 1866 law was meant to ban private discrimination in contracts. But last year, the Supreme Court said it would consider reversing that decision. Today, the court declined to reverse itself, but by a 5-4 vote, the newly solidified conservative majority cut the 1976 ruling back to the bare bones. The court's ruling came in the case of Brenda Patterson, a black bank employee who claimed that for 10 years she was racially harassed on the job, called names, made to sweep the floor, denied wage increases, promotions, and finally fired. Today, the Supreme Court majority ruled against most of her claims because it said the Civil War statute applies only at the time of a hire or promotion. Court majority said that the 1866 Act does not outlaw racial discrimination in conditions of employment or in firings. Thus, the court said Patterson had no right to sue for racial harassment, denial of wage increases, or her firing, even if it was racially motivated. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
3 workers were sentenced to death in Shanghai today for their parts in pro-democracy demonstrations. They were convicted of burning a train June 6th after 6 demonstrators were killed barricading the tracks. In Beijing, Chinese television reported on the widening crackdown against the pro-democracy movement, showing the arrested leaders being crowded into police vans with signs describing their alleged crimes. President Bush took his anti-crime campaign to Georgia today, where he signed draft legislation aimed at helping law enforcement agencies. We get details from Eric Cravey.
President Bush told a crowd of 10,000 at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center that his $1.2 billion Comprehensive Crime Control Act of 1989 will back up lawmen where it counts, on the streets and in the courtrooms. In almost 100-degree heat, Bush said he wants to put an end to drug-related crimes.
Those who use a semi-automatic weapon in federal crimes, or so much as have one during the commission of a crime, will do an automatic 10 years in federal prison, and I mean 10 years.
Bush says the lives of loved ones and fellow law enforcement officers cannot be plea bargained away. Therefore, he wants federal prosecutors to end plea bargaining for violent federal offenders. He's also calling for the maximum penalty for criminals who commit crimes where guns are involved, the death penalty. For National Public Radio, I'm Eric Cravey in Brunswick, Georgia.
Ambassadorial nominee Donald Gregg continued to insist he did not know at the time about Oliver North's secret efforts to resupply the Nicaraguan Contras. Gregg, who served as then-Vice President George Bush's national security advisor, told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today that he felt betrayed when he finally learned that his associate, former CIA agent Felix Rodriguez, had been recruited to help in North's operation. Committee members considering Gregg's nomination challenged his credibility and his judgment. Gregg's role in the Iran-Contra affair has never been fully explained. He's President Bush's choice to serve as ambassador to South Korea. The Federal Reserve today reported a 0.3-point drop in the operating rate of the nation's factories, mines, and utilities last month. The decline to 83.8% in May matches the capacity utilization recorded in March. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 29 points to close at 2474.81. Declines led advances 2-1. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the Soviet Union, it appears that rock music groups either record for the state record company Melodia, or they produce tapes of their own and distribute them through an underground network. Now, some Russian rock, like vodka, black bread, and caviar, is being marketed here. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of three albums, including one from Zvuki Mu.
Ты станцуем на столе то, что я думал о тебе, то, что подумал вчера.
I'm not going to pretend to know a lot about the social context from which the new Russian rock music has emerged, and obviously it's very hard for an American to know whether the music that's being released over here is the best the country has to offer, or just the stuff with the right business connections. But there's a pretty good new book about this subject called Back in the USSR by the Russian journalist Artemy Troitsky. Troitsky's book makes it clear that one of the most famous rock musicians in Russia is Boris Grebenshikov. He's also the Russian rocker receiving the most noticeable American push right now. His new album, Radio Silence, has just been released by Columbia Records, by far the biggest label to sign a Russian act. Radio Silence was produced by Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics, and I'm afraid it's pretty mediocre. Grebenshikov is 35, and he's the leader of one of Russia's oldest rock bands, Aquarium. He's being promoted as a solo act here, however. On the evidence of the music on Radio Silence, 10 of whose 12 songs are sung in English, he seems equally influenced by the Beatles and Jethro Tull. Here's a bit from Real Slow Today.
These ladies are laughing at me. Can I join the fun? I know I'm haunted. Keeps the flame bright. I guess I can say I'm alright. Just a burning arrow stuck in my heart. Well, anyway.
Things gonna get real slow today.
On this record, Boris Grebenshikov ends up sounding like a standard-issue American corporate rocker, something he certainly is not. Like a lot of Russian rockers, he's risked being arrested for making music, even though it's not particularly political, and has had to spend most of his life working menial jobs. But unfortunately, all too often, he sounds like a cross between Julio Iglesias and Engelbert Humperdinck.
Some people say you're not here anymore, but you're triste and proud and laugh and let them pass. So mischievous and holy. And this is a question I'll never want to ask.
There's someone out here and she wants to be growing. There's a river down here and she wants to go back to the sea.
I am your child, mother, crying to be consoled. Now that I know you,
do you recognize me?
A more interesting Russian act is Kino, spelled K-I-N-O, Russian for cinema. Kino's album called Grupa Krovi, or Blood Type, has just been released here by Gold Castle Records. Kino is a Leningrad band that claims to have been heavily influenced by American and English punk rock, but as you can hear from the album's title song, it's a more melodic version of that rough-and-tumble music. Finally, there's a Russian act whose music falls somewhere between the two I've already played. The band is called Zvuki Mu. It translates into a loose, self-deprecating pun about the sound of music, or the sound of moo cows. The band's new album, also called Zvuki Mu, is released here on Opal Records and produced by Brian Eno. Based on a couple of interviews and music videos I've seen, Zuki Mu's leader, Peter Mamonov, is very much influenced by turn-of-the-century avant-garde art movements like Dada, Surrealism, and his own country's constructivism. The lyrics are non sequiturs, the music is more conventional, but it's also got a kind of dreamy wackiness to it. In that book I mentioned, back in the USSR, Artemy Troitsky describes Peter Mamonov as a witty drunkard, a wild dancer, and a failed poet. And he mentions a solo acoustic performance he saw Mamonov give that consisted of the musician playing, quote, two-chord rock with screams, hisses, and howls. Now that's the kind of Russian rock I'd like to hear more of.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Zvuki Mu performs at Lincoln Center's Serious Fun Festival in July. Вы слушаете Fresh Air. Starts on a high point and goes up from there. The towering Gothic facade of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine looks over Morningside Heights on New York's Upper West Side, the highest plot of ground in Manhattan. With two other venerable institutions on what's called the Acropolis, St. Luke's Hospital and Columbia University, it's been taking care of bodies, minds, and souls for over a century. But since the arrival in 1972 of the cathedral's charismatic dean, James Parks Morton, there's been a whole lot of shaking going on up there on the high ground.
I think it staggers the imagination for a lot of people, first of all, because it is such an extraordinary place. I mean, it's a great, great, great building.
And this is music for a great building, a great space, from the Missa Gaia, or Earth Mass, commissioned by the cathedral from Paul Winter. There are times, and this struck me when I was there, it takes the organist a second or two to hear his trumpet pipe from the other end of the building, two football fields away. This Earth Mass, named after Gaia, the Earth Goddess, was written to include whale songs, wolf songs, literally all the creatures of the planet. That's about the size of the cathedral's vision, to encompass more than just blue-blood Episcopalians, but Buddhists, Muslims, and America's own native people. Last Thanksgiving, there was an elaborate ritual of reconciliation with the native peoples, a thanks for how they had sustained the first settlers with food, an apology for historic wrongs, and like incense, the sweet smell of forgiveness.
We had four chiefs from four different directions in the country, from the Northlands and the East and from the South and from the West. And these four chiefs and their wives were standing in front of the high altar.
Did you burn sweet grass?
Oh, yes, everyone was given sweet grass when they came in the cathedral. And It was extraordinary. And then the evening terminated in the most extraordinary way with the four chiefs and their wives, plus the drummers, and Orrin Lyons, who's an Onondaga chief as well. He said, of course, we all end up with a sacred dance. Then I think a lot of the non-Indians thought, well, we'll see the Indians dance. He said, oh, no, this is all of us dancing together if we're talking about reconciliation. And so the cathedral was turned into a long hut, and the chairs were pushed back, and everyone joined hands, and the Indians and the non-Indians, I mean, all Americans, danced together.
It's been a major mission of the cathedral under Dean Morton to realign Western, European, urban worship with notions that are more at home in Native American spirituality, like the sacredness of the earth.
I think that we can divide the world now sort of into the before the moonshot photographs and after the moonshot photographs. I think truly the experience of seeing the earth as this tiny blue, white, green, beautiful Christmas tree ornament against a void of black has opened up people's imaginations and minds in ways that are just totally, totally new, because you see it, a totality, you see a togetherness, you see a sort of God's total creation.
Environmentalists, ecologians, were speaking out from the cathedral's pulpit long before they had a wide audience in the culture at large.
We started back in 1975 when René Dubos, the great sort of dean of American ecologists, became a colleague of the cathedral and began preaching at the cathedral and speaking of the issues of the environment as the issues within which theological work and theological language and theological thinking has got to take place. That we begin within an earth construct. We begin within a nature construct. Now, most seminary thinking was totally different from that. The earth was something you stood on, but you were elevated above it, and you were of a different species. It's very unbiblical because, I mean, the center of the biblical stuff is, you know, you were of the earth, you know, you were dust, and to dust shall you return. I mean, this is pretty fundamental stuff in the scriptures. But although we mouthed that, we didn't believe it. And most medieval theology and Reformation theology and counter-Reformation theology and modern theology, the earth was just not even in the equation. You didn't think about it. It's only very, very recently that this kind of thinking, and thanks to people...
Thomas Berry.
Father Berry, again, a canon of this cathedral. Tom Berry, I met in 1975 with René Dubos, and those two men are the two who turned me around and made me understand that this was the context in which I had to preach.
And the drought last summer, of course, meant that at last there were a lot of ears to hear. But Dean Morton has always been more than just a preacher. He's been a masterful impresario, and he knows the value of images, ritual, and symbol. For the feast day of St. Francis of Assisi, he cooked up a procession of animals that included horses, camels, a llama, and hundreds of cats and dogs, all led into the cathedral by an elephant.
The great bronze doors open. Those doors usually just open for the bishop on Easter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they open for the elephant. And... But this last year, it moved even into another dimension of symbolism, which was extraordinary because it was headed by the elephant, seconded by the camel, and thirded by the llama, and then a great horse. And there were about 18 animals, including a large macaw and an 18-foot snake, and these wonderful beasts going down. And then the head of the Gaia Institute, a guy by the name of Paul Mankiewicz, carried a large glass jar in which were 6 trillion, I repeat, 6 trillion blue-green algae.
If that sounds a bit like conceptual art, it does make the serious point that all creatures, great and small, do fit into St. John the Divine's cosmology. The cathedral has broken ground in making for new dialogue among the faiths as well.
in looking back from the moon to the earth, the Episcopal nature of the earth isn't what first of all sort of hits me on the head.
Yeah.
Not even its Anglican nature, not even its Christian nature. I mean, you know, I mean, all of these things are true and they're all there, but I don't even see New York.
Which isn't to say that the cathedral isn't directly involved in the problems of New York. It's sheltered the homeless not only under its towering roof, but it shelters in three other boroughs. And it's doing something altogether unique for kids in the neighborhood, Harlem, center of the worst drug dealing and despair in the city. It's teaching them to carve stone. They're still building St. John the Divine. They've been at it since 1927, and they're still a few years from finishing it. But those kids are doing it by hand, with mallets and chisels, just like the 13th century.
Well, something that's happened in the last year that's very exciting is we've expanded our workforce and created a separate corporation called Cathedral Stoneworks, Inc., which is restoring and providing stone for buildings that need stone and stone projects all over the metropolitan area.
So postmodern ornamentation came along just in time to save your...
Well, postmodern ornamentation came along just at the nick of time, and also the what's called the preservation movement, and which is a sensitivity towards one's past and a great passion for restoring important old buildings, and everyone wants to steal our workers, which I'm thrilled about.
You're selling them off at a good price, I hope?
Yep.
Are you going to be finished in time, and do you have a deadline?
Yes, the day before the second coming.
What, do you, can you say when that is?
No, I'm not quite sure.
Will you make it?
It was a little bit of luck.
We'll get you to the church on time. My guest has been the very Reverend James Parks Morton, Dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Tim. We are leading with the Supreme Court decision, another in a series of very important decisions from the High Court affecting civil rights. And we will have Robert Siegel, who is ordinarily a co-host of All Things Considered, who's been on assignment in Germany for some time. He will be reporting on the popularity of Soviet leader Gorbachev in Germany. We will be covering events in China with our people who are still there. And, of course, we have a play for you today. It's called Storm Reading. It's part of the very special Arts Festival, and it's a very special experience.
Thanks, Linda. These stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. First you see it, and then you see it again.
We're the best, we're the beautiful, we're the only Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters. Yes, we're back.
Ghostbusters 2 opens this weekend. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
This is, you guessed it, a kinder, gentler Ghostbusters. It's pleasant in its ramshackle way, and it's often pretty funny, but this movie doesn't exactly sweep you into its grip. It's nice, but distant, like all those headlines about the Bush puppies. Soft news. Not that the first Ghostbusters was an urgent edge-of-your-seat affair. But there was a subversive element in it. The ghosts would try to scare you, or at least make your eyes pop, and there would be Bill Murray in the corner of the screen shrugging them off. He couldn't help it. His sense of irony is so complete that he seemed to be shrugging off the movie itself. In Ghostbusters 2, everybody's shrugging. The whole movie's a shrug. The sequel takes for granted that you not only saw the first one, but that you thought about it, bought its merchandise, clasped its concepts to your bosom. It assumes you know all about slime and its properties. that you know who the Ghostbusters are, and that you'll be saddened to find Bill Murray now hosting a phony psychic TV show, and Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson now performing at birthday parties. It assumes, in other words, that nothing it presents to you will surprise you, and in a way that's true. So the director, Ivan Reitman, wisely relies on his performers to liven things up. Peter McNichol makes an especially ingenious villain. Rick Moranis and Annie Potts discover true love. And Bill Murray gets all kind and gentle, albeit in his uniquely weird way, with Sigourney Weaver's new baby.
Well, what do you think?
He's ugly. I mean, he's not Elephant Man ugly, but he's not attractive. Was his father ugly?
Don't listen.
And he stinks.
You're right, senor.
Did his father stink? Yeah. Daddy was a smelly, huh? What's your name?
His name is Oscar.
Oh, named after a hot dog. You poor man. You poor, poor man.
Domesticating Bill Murray is a strange idea, but it works surprisingly well. In Ghostbusters 2, he sets up housekeeping with Weaver, and you gradually begin to see how his deeply ingrained insincerity can coexist with all the usual sensitive male virtues, how he can be caring and cool all at once. And his skeptical demeanor is like a compass. If you want to find the hippest attitude toward every conceivable incident, you look where Murray's pointing. His mocking disposition keeps the movie clean, even when it threatens to get gooey, and believe me, it does. Weaver's baby, you see, is the plot's linchpin. It seems the ghost of a medieval Carpathian fiend wants to enter its body so as to be reborn and take over the world. And in ways that are not entirely clear, he's being aided in his scheme by a river of slime that runs underneath New York City. Oh, and New York's bad attitudes don't help any. The more wicked and negative and corrupt New Yorkers are, the more that river of slime swells and threatens. In other words, Ghostbusters 2 is urging us all to be nice to each other and cultivate positive feelings, and that way, innocent babes won't have to be afraid of no ghosts. But the movie doesn't cram its mush down our throats very forcefully. In fact, it doesn't do anything very forcefully. Ghostbusters 2 is itself a kind of phantom. You can see right through it, and when it's over, you're not quite sure it was ever really there.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair, and he's a contributing correspondent to West 57th.
What is it, honey?
It's that darn ghost again. He just won't leave us alone. I guess we're just going to have to move.
No, wait! Don't worry. We're not moving. He is.
Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters!
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we meet musician Johnny Cunningham as a member of the Celtic band Silly Wizard. Cunningham plays music that's centuries old, but he's not sanctimonious about traditional music. In fact, he's cutting his first rock and roll record. And commentator Eileen Segalov examines the latest clash between tradition and technology, talking baseball cards. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Tim Wilson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.